Romeo Indy Whiskey. And my name is Dick. Call here John, KC2WGB, and I'm Paul, WS2N. The three of us act as net control for the TechNet. It's a gathering of the clan where we amateurs discuss our favorite subject, wireless technique, ham radio in particular, and some portion of the 25 or 26 different kinds of ham radio get discussed on this TechNet. TechNet's been around for 30 years, began in September of 1982, a long time ago, a lot of water under the bridge since then. And at that time, Hip and I, KC2, FDJ, I think it was called letters, at the time, he and I thought that we'd answer people's questions. A couple of weeks later, it'd all be over. We suddenly realized that there's a tremendous thirst for knowledge on how radios work. The books do a mediocre job. The schools do a mediocre job of explaining it. You can get a guy with a real high scholastic index coming out of a good school where he's studying wireless engineering. And can he design a radio? Can he design an antenna? Can he design a receiver or a transmitter? The answer is approximately no. Get a guy with a computer science degree, he can start doing that kind of work a week or two after he comes out of the school. So there's something missing, as you can tell. If you really want somebody who understands radio, you hire a ham radio operator. Because they're the guys who have demonstrated the interest. They've built stuff with their hands. They've compared knowledge by getting on the air and talking to each other. I'm using a so-and-so antenna. It worked this way. I started using a such-and-such antenna some time ago. It didn't work as well. You can see information is being transferred with the hardware over the real or radio circuit, so to speak. That's part of how it's so successful, why it works.
Repeater, timeout.
And we do have to give an interruption every minute or so and wait for all four beeps. It's four beeps, plus another second or so, so that the guys out of the area, like Scott and Jim, VE3ZTZ and VE3JIW up there in Canada, so they get a chance to come through. Our frequently sign-in people. The TechNet tries to tap into that very large amount of brain power that exists in the tri-state area of northern New Jersey, western Connecticut, southern New York State, and Long Island. That's what this particular repeater covers. And as I said, there's a lot of brain power in that area. As such, when a particular subject is being discussed, somebody will say, hey, I've got some experience in that area. He chimes in. We get the benefit of his wisdom. There's no guarantee that everything here on the TechNet is, at the first time you hear it, going to be 100% accurate. Every engineer, if he's realistic, realizes he doesn't bat 1,000. He's not right all the time. And sometimes we transmit some errors. So there's a kind of peer review going on here because by way of this beautiful website being run by Mike Perry, KC2NJI, every one of the TechNets get recorded for the last 6.5 years. Let me drop. You can go to Mike's website at www.amateurradio.tangovictor. Amateurradio.tangovictor. There's 6.5 years of recordings there. The TechNet itself, in the very beginning, used to be 1 hour per Sunday night, and then people were complaining there wasn't enough time to answer all the questions, and it became 2 hours, 3 hours. Right now it's 4 hours. Starts at 8 o'clock at night, ends midnight local time for the last 6 years approximately. So there's a lot of material on those recordings. You go to the right year, the right month, the right weekend, the right hour, and listen to one of those recordings. And when there are mistakes that sometimes occur, somebody says, hey, I listened to the recording last weekend, and you said it was 47 megacycles, and it's really 50 megacycles. So it gets corrected eventually. Peer reviewed, if you know what I mean. There was a hamvention, a flea market or whatever, that was run by this particular repeater group, Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club, at Briarcliff College today. So you guys who have had some good bargains, I'd like to hear about that. Those who attended, tell us what it was like, how much sunburn did you get, and so on. How much windburn and sunburn did you get? But apparently a good crew gathered, and lots of hardware and a little bit of money changed hands. Let me drop. Oh, I see. I forgot to turn on my speech processor. Now, this is the speech processor off, which is a very soft voice, and with it on, a little bit of more punch to the voice. lot of certain words get covered up, I know which words to cover, which words to repeat. If, for instance, you do hear things that you think shouldn't be there, we'd like to hear from you as to what you've heard. By that I mean, if some form of inappropriate signals are being present on this net at any time, please press your reverse button on your transceiver so that you can listen to the input frequency, 146.25. And whatever you hear, amplitude, when you heard it, record the exact amount of time you heard it, and please send us an email at rfi@limarc.org. RFI stands for Radio Frequency Interference, RFI@LIMARC, Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club. So rfi@limarc.org. You give us a report as to what hour you heard, what signal strength. What we care most about is what signal strength, what hour. In many cases, the signal itself is intentionally very weak. And as such, if you're running an all-mode transceiver, like my case right now, you're listening to a Kenwood TS-711 that transmits both sideband as well as FM. You may have to go over to not only the reverse mode, input frequency, but listen in the sideband mode to listen to the weakness of the carrier and tell us how strong it was, what you heard. And by way of gathering information from multiple guys, multiple locations, multiple times, it'll help pin down the source of those signals. Okay. A little bit later on, first I'll tell you what the menu is. Let me drop. And by the way, the menu for the TechNet has evolved over the years. People complain that, this guy, K2LIW, is much too verbose. He goes on much too long, and I have to wait way too long to get an answer. That was some of the complaints in the beginning. And what we finally settled on is a technique by which the first hour, general ham radio questions, brief answers. After that, followed by the mailbag, where John, KC2WGB, tells us what kinds of snail mails and emails he has gotten from hams who don't yet have their license or don't yet have the equipment by which they can talk to us live on the air. That's the main approach by which this TechNet works, live on the air answers. There are people who wish we would be giving written, free consulting services throughout the rest of the week. And I don't blame them for asking for it, but it's beyond the call of duty. That's not being promised. So first hour, brief answers. After that, the mailbag. And after that, Paul, WS2N, our space expert, tells us what National Aeronautics and Space Administration has been doing in this particular week. I'm kind of interested as to whether or not the Kepler Space Telescope, which is showing some grief, has any recovery occurred there. That's the one that's looking for exoplanets. It has discovered something like 260 Earth-like planets going around other stars in this particular galaxy. And 260 confirmed, or 275 confirmed, and 2,700 candidates. So it's finding an awful lot of potential life out there, if you know what I mean. Potential planets habitable. Let me drop. But unfortunately, one of its main inertial wheels, by which it does its very precise orientation, has failed. Of the four, two of them have already failed. It needs a minimum of three for normal operation. So that's one thing that's going to be discussed. I've also got a little bit of a puzzle I'm going to give you guys. I collect physics puzzles, and somewhere around that time I'll be giving you a physics puzzle that's, to me, interesting. And I used to also say that every ham radio operator, real ham radio operator, has a scientist inside trying to get out, and he's very curious about how radio equipment works. Well, that's not completely true. I was showing a bias when I said that. I've recently met a couple of people who I respect who brag about the fact that they are appliance operators, that the ham radio equipment, that transmitter, the receiver, and the antenna, the exact way it works, they don't care. It's a tool. It's a tool by which they do communicating by way of wireless techniques. And they use that tool for other purposes, to really help in emergency situations and to talk to their buddies on the way to work. And in my case, my house is a tool. My radio tower is a tool. My house keeps the rain off my radio equipment, and the tower keeps my antennas up in the air so I can do some communicating. Those are tools. Alrighty. During that first hour, for those who sign in by giving us their call letters, their name, and the word yes, which means they do have a question or a comment, you need not sign in just because you're listening. Don't require that. Long list of people that are listening. After 30 years of the TechNet, this is TechNet number 1452. By now, we believe somebody somewhere is listening. way up with Andy, the V2CDL, and Eric, KE2EJ, the technical mavens of this group. By way of what those two guys have done, this repeater now has internet connections by way of IRLP and Echolink, so people in other states, other countries, sometimes quite far away, check in. So there's an awful lot of potential audience out there. If we leave enough space in between each of our conversations, wait for the four beeps, and maybe 1 or 2 seconds beyond, all of that equipment gets reset. And that equipment, by the way, is in the process of being upgraded these days. Some of the internet connections are being eliminated in order to get rid of some of the latency that used to be there. So lots of changes are occurring. As I said, during the first hour, for those who check in, we give a brief answer. If your particular material requires a lot more time, occasionally I go into a pretty long, we get into a pretty long discussion because it's something of very universal value, like a guy wants to know what's the best way that I can make an invisible antenna on my apartment building where the super has sort of given me permission as long as the rest of the residents can't see it. I mean, that's a very universal ham radio need. We get into one of those and we'll discuss all the ramifications for it, or because of Hurricane Sandy, what kind of a generator should I buy? Should I buy 2 kilowatts or 20 kilowatts? And there's definite advantages of either one. And how do I wire it to my house? How do I make sure I've got very reliable standby electrical power during the times that Con Ed or LIPA or New Jersey Power and Light or Connecticut Power and Light, you know what I mean by the real names of those companies, when they go out, how do I make sure that I've got the standby power to make sure all my radio equipment can work correctly? Those kind of subjects, when we get into those, we get into a much greater discussion. But I said, brief discussions during the first hour, followed by John and Paul, and then we get into deeper discussions. And I'm going to be asking...
Repeater, time out.
I'm going to be asking you guys a puzzle at that time, which I think is kind of cute. Okay, we're going to take check-ins at this time. The way a person checks in would be saying something like this. K6 DPU. I got it wrong. NYQH, Lou and Yes. If that's the way you would sign it. Give me your call letters, your name, followed by the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. So give me your check-ins right now. K2 Rally W in the tech net. We're listening. Okay, we got Vito, and one of our frequent sign-ins. Anybody else? Give me your call letters and name right now.
WB2QGZ, Bill, and yes.
Mayor.
Okay, Bill, thank you very much. We got Vito, we got Bill. Who else is in there?
Intuix, Ian, with a question, I believe for the first hour, because it's about sending wave.
Okay, we've got a man who didn't want to tell us his name, but we know him, Wes. So we've got Vito, Bill, and Wes so far. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW.
I know this transmitter's working.
Okay, I'm hearing Joe. Okay, we got you, Joe. Anyone else? K2RIW listening?
JF. I was there today.
had gone in as a vendor and left around 10 o'clock and didn't know if you were there or not. However, it was the most enjoyable day, I have to say that, but with all due respect, and I do apologize, but there was a lot of junk there. A lot of things of no value, really. I rummaged through about several times and went around and around and around, and there was nothing of any interest whatsoever. It's just pity. Anyway, I did find a J-38 telegraph key. Is it a J-38? I believe it is. And I have a whole bunch of those. And a very interesting watt meter, SWR bridge, military version. I did see on eBay, and I was able to get that at a reasonable price. But other than that, not at all. And I was very, very, more or less, not pleased at what I saw there. And finally, before I give it back to you, you mentioned about appliance operators. Let me drop. I'm with you 100% on appliance operators. Shame on them. Shame on them, most assuredly. A ham operator should know what he's doing and understand his equipment. But we have this scenario these days. Okay, back to you, sir. With all due respect, WA2PJF is standing by.
Very fine, Vito. Glad you got that J-38 and your watt-meter swirl bridge. And the word appliance operator is relative. There are guys who get deep into how does the antenna and the transmission line and the transmitter and receiver really work. Other guys barely know how to change the fuse when they're doing troubleshooting. By the same token, we got to be careful not to show prejudice. Oh, 20 years ago, a significant number of people got into ham radio by way of their introduction through Citizens Band. And there were people who would disparage a person because he had a Citizens Band beginning. Well, some of those Citizens Band operators became extremely good ham radio operators. When it comes to so-called junk at flea markets, you've got to be a little bit careful now. You're a fairly sophisticated guy who has worked a lot with the phone company. You've seen some real good test equipment in your time. And as such, your standards are a little bit higher than the rest of ours. I can remember, for instance, my very first oscilloscope. It was an old Dumont oscilloscope that barely went up to 20 kilohertz. By modern-day standards, it's a real piece of junk, but it was an oscilloscope. And my very first transistorized circuit, I built this little square-wave switching oscillator that ran off a 1.5-volt pin-light cell. And I was so happy about the fact that the circuit as an oscillator was so efficient that I calculated that the battery would run for a month. And I wanted to see if that was really true. So I turned the thing on, had the thing displayed on my oscilloscope screen, and I let it run for a solid month. And that square wave got burned into the phosphor of that particular oscilloscope screen. But it served the purpose. So you've got a little bit higher standards than the rest of us, Vito. So other people will look at some of the things that you consider junk, and it's maybe their very first volt-ohm milliammeter, the very first vacuum tube voltmeter.
Repeater, time out.
I'm getting good at timing out the machine these days. Got to be careful. The very first piece of test equipment, even though it may be ancient, the price is right, and it serves a purpose for them. I had strong intentions of being there today. Something came along, and I didn't get there. So I didn't get a chance to meet you face to face, Vito. But glad you found something to buy. Glad to find that you not all of it was junk to you, even though your standards are a little higher than the rest of ours, so to speak. Some older pieces of equipment I really like. A person might say that the thing that you're listening to right now, this Kenwood TS711A, my favorite 2-meter all-mode rig. It's a 1987 vintage, but it's an oldie but goodie. And to get something similar today, you'd have to pay close to $2,000. You can buy these on the flea market for sometimes $200, $300. And I like the fact it's got this variable knob on the front panel where you can make it go anywhere from 130 watts of power output when it's transmitting in any one of its modes. And when it comes to feeding transverters for the upper microwave frequencies, that's a very handy function. Okay, go on to the next guy, which is Bill. Hey, Bill, we haven't heard from you for a long time. Wonder if you were at the flea market today. Did the top of your head get sunburned, but you're smart enough to wear a good hat. And how are things in the two-way radio business that you work in, which is a cell phone business, really? WB2QGZ, the microwave voice of Massapequa, K2RIW. Go ahead, Bill.
Hey, good evening. No, didn't make the flea market today, and work is good, mergers and acquisitions, yeehaw. So, here's the question for tonight. Now, I ran into a distributor of antennas here in the U.S. that gets his stuff from Japan, and we were talking about some 900 megahertz antennas that this place is going to start selling here in the U.S., and one of the big selling points was from the Japanese literature. Now, this goes from, where it gets lost in the translation is I guess, a Japanese individual that knows a little bit of English and an American fellow who knows a little bit of Japanese, and that's how the specs go back and forth, I guess. So they say that because of the particular type of stainless that they use in this whip, which is about 2.5 feet long, give or take, whatever its construction is for 900 megahertz, it has, I believe, three small open-air coils in it, in the whip, that it, this particular stainless creates less noise. And what I was trying to get to them is, well, do you mean mechanical noise, wind noise, or, because they were really kind of saying, no, we're pretty sure they mean electrical noise from the antenna. And I didn't think that that any type of stainless would cause something like that. In other words, would affect that at all, if you know what I mean. Any thoughts?
Yeah, Bill, you talked to the right guy. Although my particular situation was unusual, I definitely ran into a stainless steel problem in a 900 meg antenna. Now, my case was extreme. I was solving a problem for one of my consulting clients where he needed an extremely compact stainless steel antenna. The antenna had to be stainless steel because it was going to be exposed to a really wicked environment. It had to be physically very strong because it was not only going to be physically abused as well as abused with chemistry and whatever. And we made contact. The antenna had to be a removable assembly. And we made contact to the stainless steel antenna by way of normal silver-plated copper finger-stock material. Made contact to the two halves of this dipole antenna. And we knew that the stainless steel has a conductivity that's a little bit better than nichrome wire. You use nichrome wire to make wire-wound resistors. It's a high-resistive metallic material. And stainless steel, when you go to the right charts and find out what is its conductivity, it's a hell of a lot lower conductivity than copper. And as such, we made sure that they gold-plated the stainless steel in the vicinity where we're making contact. Well, the gold plating had to be, I think, 150 microns, something that thick, in order to have the right skin depth. And they went to a vendor that only put down 20 microns. They put down a thinness of gold that was much too small. Therefore, the contact resistance was giving us a lot of loss in the antenna and a lot of scratchy contacts. So stainless steel, raw stainless steel, as an antenna, where if this is the best of all worlds, let me drop it. You would like all portions of the antenna, particularly the areas where you're making contact to it. You would like the contact resistance. You would like the contact resistance to be milliohms, and I'm not kidding. It takes a 4-leaded ohm meter, a so-called Kelvin connection type ohm meter, in order to confirm that. But if you've got anything more than milliohms, you're getting some amount of loss in the antenna at that contact, because portions of an antenna, by definition, have very high current. Other portions are very low current. I mean, a lousy contact of 100 ohms resistance out at the tip of a dipole, no problem. At the source of a dipole in the center, where each half has got 35 ohms or 37 ohms to the radio resistance, you'd like it to be well under 3.7 ohms, hopefully 0.37 ohms of contact resistance at that point. And if there's scratchiness, you'd be amazed. In fact, listen to a relatively weak FM repeater signal on your handy talkie. Set up your handy talkie, choose a station, set the handy talkie on the table, set the, a fairly noisy station that's far away, stand in front of the antenna with two screwdrivers in your hand, a screwdriver and a fork and knife, so to speak, and just scrape those two metallic objects against each other while those metallic objects are, let me pick a number, 6 inches away from that antenna while you're listening to a weak signal. You would never think that the scratchiness of contact on these two pieces of metal in your hand scraping against each other near the antenna, where no radio contact per se takes place between those and the antenna, and you'd be amazed how much static that can create. You'll hear the static real loud on the sideband receiver, but even on an FM receiver, you're going to hear it. So you'd like there to be milliohms of contact resistance where the stainless steel joint...
Repeater, timeout.
Where the stainless steel joins the coils, where the electrical contacts are made to it, so you do have to be careful. Stainless steel is a very desirable material to make whips out of. It doesn't rust, it's pretty strong, it can take a lot of bending and a lot of flexing, but making good contact to it on a reliable antenna is something you've got to be careful about. So maybe that's some of my experience, Bill. Maybe that's a little bit about what they're talking about. There's some very nice, by the way, 900 meg Yagi antennas, three-element printed circuit Yagi antennas being sold by Kent. Whiskey Alpha 5, VictorJulietBravo.com. You go to that website, to the A5, VictorJulietBravo.com, and there's two reasons why you want to go there. If you want 900 meg printed circuit antennas and log periodic printed circuit antennas, they're pretty nice, inexpensive, pretty high in performance, but you go to his second page, and you find out how to make very inexpensive Yagi antennas out of coat hanger wire, for instance. Very high performance Yagi antennas, very simple driven element assembly. And so I've told a lot of people to go there. If you're building a 2-meter Yagi because you want better reception from your apartment building toward that particular repeater, and so on. So back to you, Bill. W2QGZ, T2RI, to be in the tech net.
Okay, I have experienced that metallurgical metal noise or whatever you call it with, you know, crunchy stuff in the foreground of the antenna on the weak signal. I have heard that, so. And I mean, honestly, you can even see that in a relatively high signal area sometimes as well. But, it's just, I had never really experienced that much of... This is a mobile antenna we're talking about. And I see kind of some of where this may be beneficial if it's a stainless that is more conductive. But virtually every mobile whip is stainless, so I didn't really think that was, you know, that was pretty much it. I didn't realize there was much of an issue with that. Perhaps that's where they're going. And I'm not familiar with Kent's stuff. I actually have a bunch of his little log periodics, which... we have out here with a lot of our spec ends we use for general poking around and interference and stuff. So, all right, maybe that's what's cooking. I have a demo antenna coming, so I will fool with it and report back. How's that? WB2QGZ.
Yeah, very fine, Bill. Many of the whip antennas we've used on HF on a bumper mount or whatever has a great big connector at one end with a whole lot of threads to it, so there's a lot of area of contact, and therefore it becomes very reliable. Stainless steel, as long as you've got a great big area of contact, but the fact that it's a high resistivity material, as long as the whip has got enough diameter to it, you can get away with that. So you can use resistive materials. You could, in theory, make an antenna out of fiberglass with carbon granules coated on the top of the fiberglass. As long as there's enough diameter, enough parallel paths to lower the resistance, you can make a reasonably good antenna out of that. So you got to be careful with stainless steel. As I said, you look it up in any of the good books, reference data for radio engineers, among others, and you'll find out its resistivity compared to copper. I vaguely remember it's 50 times more resistive than copper. So you got to make sure that where you're using it, the stainless steel is wide enough in wavelength, in the length of the thing, or large enough in diameter for the whip to have low enough resistance. sensitivity and the way you make contact to the ends, particularly the high high current area, which is the beginning of a dipole, for instance, or the bottom of a whip, you got to worry about those details. So many antennas are a weird mixture of things that are very sensitive and very insensitive. The tip of the dipole or the tip of the monopole, the tip of your quarter wave ground plane, where the impedance is thousands of ohms, it can get away with murder. It can have very high resistivity out there. But down at the base where the current is high, you got to be kind of careful. Okay, Wes is next. I think he said he's got a VISWR problem. N2XJN, K2LIW. Go ahead, Wes.
Yeah, N2XJN. So I have a subject of static wave. I have sent you some time ago a video that was titled How That Is Possible, Levitation of Matter in Standing Wave. No magnetic, no medium, no temperature. And it's only 1 minute, I believe 30 seconds video. It does have a Russian title on it, but it doesn't matter. It's from Oregon National Laboratory, so it's American. Let me drop. What it does is you have a wave, standing wave, and you have a matter, and the matter is mass. And you can have matter levitating, and you can have a distinctive point of the standing wave physically marked by matter just because you're using the wave. Of course, I have a certain explanation to this phenomena, but the May 28th, it was 5 days ago, was when I sent that video to you, how that is possible, levitation of matter in a standing wave. No magnetic, no medium, no temperature. Also, the video is available at bernice.handfamily.com. Did I say it properly? Back to you, John. The counter chair.
So if we go to bernie@handfamily.com, where Bernie keeps a website where he lists all of the URLs that we tend to discuss on this net. And so Wes has put that one there as of May 28th. And I did see that one. I did view that particular video, Wes. Fascinating. It is my belief that it is an acoustic standing wave being set up. In other words, in air, the equivalent of a loudspeaker, probably on top and bottom of those two structures, where they're putting water drops in between with a very fine water dropper device. They were putting very small water drops in specific locations, and each of those water drops looked to me like they were roughly an inch apart. And let me think now. Sound travels roughly in air, 1,000 feet per second. So a 1 kc wave would be 1 foot. A 10 kc wave would be roughly 1 inch. If the acoustic noise coming out of the upper and lower loudspeakers that are aimed at each other on this vertical column, so if you get a loudspeaker in the bottom aimed up, a loudspeaker in the top aimed down, is my speculation. And if you're putting something like a 10 kilohertz audio signal, and you notice that he did have an oscilloscope trace, let me drop. He had an oscilloscope trace with two separate waveforms on it, and he was slowly shifting the phase of one versus the other. So by way of, let me pick a number, a 10 kilohertz audio signal displayed on the oscilloscope, and he's looking at the phase shift difference between the upper loudspeaker and lower loudspeaker, in my speculation. He's now setting up an extremely strong acoustic standing wave in a vertical column in space, and therefore each inch apart, so to speak, there's a null in that standing wave, a peak or a null, and by carefully putting droplets of water in those areas, he had two or three droplets of water that would be suspended in air. You could see them wiggling around a little bit, but they would stay in those fixed locations. Any kind of levitation like this fascinates many people. I'm one of them. So as you. Let me drop. So those acoustic standing waves are the places where the water droplets could be suspended. Now, water is an interesting material. As you make a water droplet large, larger and larger, and it becomes more and more massive. It has a high tendency to move vertically under the influence of gravity, and stopping it is very difficult. If you make a water droplet, an aerosol droplet, small enough, its motion through air becomes extremely slow. If you had a high humidity room so that the water droplet is not immediately evaporating, and you made a water droplet small enough, just by dropping in air by way of gravity, it may take it 5 minutes to drop a few feet if the water droplet is small enough. That's just the way the Brownian motion and the way a very small aerosol works in the presence of air. So if he makes his water droplet small enough and he sets up the right kind of acoustic wave, he can get these 2, 3, and 4 water droplets suspended in air, and that's what he did. Fascinating thing to watch. And what you're hearing are my speculations as to what I think was happening. I wonder if your speculations and when you did the translation from the Russian to English, did you get some confirmation of what I'm speculating there with? N2XJN, fascinating thing to watch. KQLIW in the TechNet.
N2XJN, well, that was a Russian title on a video from Argon, A-A-R-G-O-N, laboratory, so it's an American soil, an American experiment. The technology uses the frequency of 22 kilohertz. So there are two parts of the apparatus, and both of them are speakers. And, of course, 22 kilohertz is beyond the human range of hearing, which is good because that also took to take into consideration the energy level of it. And the energy level would be straight proportional to the lifting power. Now, we're talking about lifting power. It's not lifting power, it's the trapping power. Ladies and gentlemen. The droplets are trapped in the nodes of the wave. So, what technology is being used for, it was originally developed by NASA, and then the technology took advantage of it because drug companies could now levitate the substance and let it dry out of the water to the crystal form without touching the glass. So the contamination is very much unlike. I'm recently starting the spectroscopy and any kind of spectroscopy, including the X-ray spectroscopy, which actually is very much important to have a pure form of the sample that you're going to be trying to investigate in terms of its contents. So this method could deliver you a pure sample of given choice for you to study it further. That's why this technology is pretty much in commercial use right now. But there's something interesting in here. In 2003, there was a discovery in Göbekli Tepe, Turkey. I'm going to spell it because it's very interesting for you to go to that site. G O with the 2 O dot above it, B E K L I, and the last the second word is T E P E in Turkey, which is a piezoelectric temple. That means it is scientifically proven and researched that the stones that are found inside in 1995 when they started the discovery based on one of the farmers who found the heavy stone. They have a acoustic architectural features in that megalithic site that is very much similar to the one in Malta. And there is another place I forgot which has the same effect. And also the hieroglyphs on it shows levitation of the object, but levitation also of the physical bodies. One of the bodies is next to presenting the sending waves, is also presenting you levitating of an animal. That would be nothing interesting about from somebody imagining things being presented on the readings, if not a scientific paper that was done by Mr. Cervenka based on the ground from the research has been done by CTU International Grant, that is the European grant given in, I try to find the year of it, but 1998, that was studying and giving all of the equations about non-linearity setting waves in acoustic resonance towards with the orbital reflection coefficients, and there was targeting this particular historic site. N2G.
Yeah, because you said that was running at 22 kilohertz, and that I didn't know, that means the wavelength in air is something like half an inch, and that gives him a lot closer spacing for the individual water drops. Now, that acoustic standing wave that he was setting up by an upper and lower loudspeaker with these ultrasonic 22 kilohertz audio signals being displayed on the oscilloscope, coming out of the loudspeaker, making the standing wave vertical column, and two, three, or four water droplets are suspended in the right spot. That technique has a little bit of similarity to what goes on in the Large Hadron Collider over there in the CERN situation in Switzerland, where there you're trying to make individual bundles of protons in the actual material that they're accelerating. It's hard to believe that millions and millions of protons in the individual bundles, and I think there's either hundreds or thousands of these bundles, all moving around in these two separate rings. One ring goes clockwise, one ring goes counterclockwise, and by way of all of the focusing, they're doing radio focusing, which has a little degree of similarity to this acoustic focusing that you're describing here with the standing wave. But it's making bundles of water in your experiment. They're making bundles of protons or electrons, and they've got millions of protons in each bundle, and you allow these bundles, some of them going around clockwise, some of them going around counterclockwise, and with millions of protons per bundle colliding with each other, common sense would lead you to believe you're going to be getting millions of collisions, not necessarily, because of the extremely high accuracy required for individual protons to smash into each other. Each individual bundle may have a couple of million protons.
Repeater, timeout.
You got a couple of million protons in the one particular bundle going clockwise, a couple of million protons in the other bundle going counterclockwise, and you think they're smashing into each other. Well, only a couple of collisions will actually take place, and all of their very fancy detectors figure out what is the magnetic field, the polarity, the trajectory, the mass, and how many of them. These calorimeter-like detectors that are as big as a house around the point of collision collect the debris and figure out what took place and what it all means. So setting up standing waves to create bundling, whether it be water drops in air or whether it be protons going through an accelerator, there's a strong similarity there. I'm going to move on now to the next guy, which was Joe, W2RYY. How are things going in your neighborhood tonight, Joe? And did you get a chance to go to the flea market? W2RYY, K2RYW in the TechNet.
No, I did not get a chance to go to the tech test today. I was doing other things. But what I will bring up, the subject of looking for a particular type of device to hunt down my part on a circuit board, and I sort of found that in a roundabout way.
I think you passed it back to me, Joe. I know that last week we suggested that you use a vibrating toothbrush, loudspeaker. There's all kinds of ways of doing it. Also, I was reading an article, trying to remember now which journal it was. The Wenzel Company. Wenzel Company makes very precise crystal oscillators. And the way you mount a piezoelectric crystal in order to get the highest possible Q is such that you're suspending it by the wires. You've got two contact wires going to the actual crystal, and in many cases there's an electroplated coating on two different sides of the crystal, and these two wires connect to that, and that in turn gets suspended inside of the crystal housing. And so you want as little as possible mechanical support for the crystal, because it only develops high Q if it has completely free resonance. The way it mechanically flexes itself, you want it to have completely free motion. If you mounted it in a block of wood, for instance, you would be dampening the mechanical vibration. You'd be lowering the Q of the crystal. So you're between a rock and a hard place. And the way you support the crystal so that it can tolerate high G impacts and yet get high Q out of it. And your particular frequency synthesizer is part of those handy talky radios that go into a very rugged industrial environment where people are dropping them on the ground and hitting things with them and whatever. I know that those crystals are experiencing extremely high G impacts from time to time. And what this article was telling me, let me drop it, is because any kind of physical flexing of the crystal is going to be changing its electrical properties. So if you take a high Q crystal that's part of an oscillator circuit, put it on a shake table and shake the whole printed circuit at, say, for instance, 10 kilohertz, and you look at the spectral purity of the oscillation out of that crystal. You'll find the typical characteristic Gaussian-shaped curve of signal amplitude versus horizontal frequency on a spectrum analyzer-like display. And in the case of many of these crystals, you shake it at a 10 kilohertz rate, 10 kilohertz away from the crystal resonating frequency, you'll find an upper and lower sideband 10 kilohertz away. In other words, it's creating a kind of FM modulation or amplitude modulation or both phase modulation. So mechanically vibrating a crystal at some particular acoustic frequency will create side lobes at that frequency away from the crystal when it's oscillating. Now you take that kind of a phenomenon of a crystal, part of a printed circuit board where maybe the hold-on handy-talkie was dropped and it experienced 1,000 G's of impact on a concrete surface, I guarantee that that quartz crystal could experience some kind of internal change. So when it comes to your analysis as to which component is giving you the grief, the first one I would look for is the crystal itself. Even though the crystal is mounted very solidly to that board and soldered down, still that method of mounting means that it doesn't have, it doesn't have very much shock absorbing characteristics in the way it was mounted. So you give that printed circuit board 1,000 G shock, and that crystal is experiencing 1,000 G shock. So I am guessing of those failed boards, you're going to find a significant number of them where the crystal itself is the source of the microphonic problem. What Joe has experienced is that he's doing troubleshooting of these boards. He's piling up quite a number of the bad ones that he's got to replace. It's a fairly expensive subassembly. He, being a typical ham radio operator, would love to fix the thing itself rather than an expensive repair, a expensive complete replacement of the whole printed circuit board itself. And I think he's going to find the crystal is the actual failed component. And I know that with the surface mounting and whatever, it's going to take quite a bit of resources in order to unsolder a suspicious crystal and solder a known good one in there. But when that's done, I think the microphonic effect in some cases is going to disappear. The microphonic effect that Joe has experienced is sometimes so severe that when the radio is listening to a signal and somebody turns up the volume control loud, loud enough, the shaking of the loudspeaker into the handy-talky radio, into this printed circuit board, and its microphonic characteristic of its synthesizer, we create acoustic feedback, and the whole radio goes into a squeal. And that's part of what Joe is analyzing. So I think my money is on the crystal as to the bad guy, Joe. We'll soon find out as you finish your investigation. And were you able to find something that can conveniently vibrate for you? That'd be 82RYY, KQRIW in the TechNet.
Yes, sometimes necessity is the mother of invention. I think you've heard that before. I took a tool called an engraver. Now, the engraver by itself, plugged into 120 volts, is destructive as soon as you touch parts on the circuit board, obviously. So, taking that same idea, I decided to, let's try see if we can reduce the power going to the vibrating tool. And I did that through using a variac. I brought the power input down to about 40, 45 volts. I reduced the vibration to such a point where I can put my finger directly on the tip of this thing and I can hardly feel the vibration. Now, of course, this tool has a metal tip on it, so I took the metal tip out and substituted a nice, reasonably long plastic, not plastic, a wood toothpick. The toothpick was fairly, fairly sturdy, cut in half. And that gave me a way of at least touching the different parts of the board and introducing a 60-cycle hum when I touch a bad part. And it did seem to work, but the basis of it is of using what I said. And it seemed to work actually pretty good because I tried looking for the thing on the internet. So for starting making this type of device, and I really just didn't come up with anything at all. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, that's pretty crafty. So the engraving tool, running that 45 volts, 60 cycle AC instead of 120 volts, definitely lowers its amount of vibration. The toothpick as the tool on the end of it, as opposed to the metal probe, gives you a controlled amount of vibration. So now by turning the voltage up and down, the 45 volts, you control the magnitude. 60 cycles is as good a number as any as to the vibrating rate. And as you start touching individual components, you're eventually going to find the bad guy. And so I sense from what you're saying, you've now perfected the process of finding a probe. You're doing acoustic injection. You're doing a kind of troubleshooting where you're injecting an acoustic signal instead of an RF signal like we usually do with the troubleshooting procedure, signal tracing procedure. And so it sounds to me like you're getting very close to the point where you're going to take a number of these PC boards, probably at the factory where you do your work, and start touching them to find out where the microphonics is. So is that possibly what you're going to be doing during your free time on Monday tomorrow, John? Here we go, Joe. To be 2RYY, K2RYW in the TechNet.
No, not quite. Well, let me put it in terms of what you've heard before. Let's see, how's it go? The good news and the bad news. Well, it works something like this. I took a known good synthesizer apart and compared it to a bad one, and it actually gave me very similar results as far as touching the same components and the same parts of the circuit board. It gave me the same results looking at it on the service monitor. So I'm not sure what direction to go in right now. And when I touched the crystal, by the way, because I know you keep on saying the crystal really didn't have much of an effect with generating a frequency that you could see as far as something it would modulate. It had more to do with a specific chip cap and a inductor type of part on the board and one of those tuned circuits. Those three parts in that small corner of the board had the most effect of anything. But yeah, as I said, a known good synthesizer did the same thing, so it makes me think it could be these parts. And something else I'm missing, or like, that I'm just not seeing. I don't know. So when I do get back to it, I'll keep some notes and I'll get back to you and let you know.
From the article I've read, Joe, every frequency synthesizer has a certain transfer characteristic of mechanical vibration versus residual amplitude or phase, let's call it angular or amplitude modulation, of the output of the synthesizer. Every synthesizer on planet Earth that mankind has ever created, you put it on the right kind of a shake table, and you shake it at the 1 kc, 10 kc, 50 kc, 100 hertz, whatever, you're going to find a frequency where, as you shake your synthesizer, you're going to find components in the output frequency spectrum, the spectral purity, that show that characteristic. Every synthesizer in the world has that. The only thing left to discuss is how much. The fact that you found an effect with a so-called good board is not yet discouraging information. It's the magnitude. I am guessing that a good board has one part per million, so to speak, of mechanical vibration versus a residual modulation of the output, and a bad board has got five parts per million. In other words, the bad board has just enough acoustic transferred spectral purity degradation in its output that's just bad enough that when the loudspeaker is turned up high, the whole system goes back into a squeal, goes into an acoustic oscillation. But a good board is a little bit lower in magnitude and therefore doesn't quite hit the threshold where it goes into oscillation. So the fact that you've seen mechanical vibration creating the problem doesn't mean you're home free. Let me drop. You're now going to have to be quantitative, and that's not easy, I'll admit. In other words, a specific component you touch at a particular hardness of touching with your toothpick and your engraving tool vibrator creates a certain amount of display change in performance, and I think when you look at it carefully, you're going to find a bad board versus a good board. Both have the effect, but one has more of the effect than the other. You're not looking for a printed circuit board where there is no acoustic transfer at all. They all have it. You cannot build a synthesizer that's not going to take some of the mechanical vibration and give you some amount of residual amplitude of phase modulation in the resultant output. That's just the nature of the beast. If you really figure out what's trying to go on with the frequency synthesizer, it's got a very difficult job of taking this free-running voltage-controlled oscillator that really wants to squitter all over the place, and by taking a whole lot of samples of its instantaneous output frequency into your phase lock loop circuit, you come to the conclusion that during this microsecond it's a little bit high in frequency and your electronics is going to demand it to go down, and the next microsecond is a little bit lower in frequency and your electronics is going to demand that it goes up. And the overall picture is now it's making very high spectral purity of the output, but it's not perfect. Your feedback gain, your loop of that circuit, the feedback gain cannot be infinity, therefore the amount of correction the phase lock loop gives is finite. It's making the oscillator a lot more stable, but can never make it perfect. Does that make some sense as to what I think you're looking for here, Joe? For the A2RYY, and you're into a high-tech area here, K2RAW in the TechNet.
Well, Dick, what I was kind of looking for would be a component that sort of was standing out above other ones that made the most difference when you touched it. And so far, I haven't really found that. And I know what you're saying about one part might require so much pressure to make it react so much. Another might require half that amount of pressure to make it react so much. I do understand that. That's getting a little tough to try to measure that. I have to do some more measures of these things and see. But the whole board reacts to, like, you know, tapping on it. Obviously I can't make this vibrating thing. I can't make it change frequencies. It operates at line frequency. I wish I could to get something a little lower frequency so I could, you know, probably lock onto it a little easier looking at the sample waveform. It would give me a better picture than, you know, for resolution, but so far that's not what I've got. At least I've got something available to be able to tell me, yes, I touch it. It gives me a reaction when I touch it with the